If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
And so being able to have those tough conversations, even when you've got a lot of earnest money that is about to go hard and you really want to do the deal, but the partnership isn't right and you walk away from it because you just know that this marriage is going to end in a rough divorce down the road.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Nick Brown is a lawyer by trade, but after a few years of corporate litigation, he pivoted to active residential multifamily investing, scaling his business to 575 units through 506B syndications. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sam, thank you for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, man, this is great. This is great. You know, the same questions I ask everybody who comes on is, can you give us a brief overview where you started, where are you now, and how did you get there?
Yeah, absolutely. So born and raised in Fulton, Mississippi, small town, midway through college or junior year of college, dropped out, joined the Coast Guard, and served Portland, Miami, San Francisco, and then back in Portland. Got out after the tour, went to law school, and then got into multifamily real estate, you know, shortly after finishing up a clerkship after law school, and grew the portfolio from three units in 2013 and up to 575 to present day.
Gotcha. No, that's awesome. That's awesome. Was there a light bulb day or light bulb moment when you just said, I don't think that law is for me?
You know, I actually loved practicing law. I had a lot of fun doing it. We were in corporate litigation. So as you know, the constant challenge of there's zero sum game, right? For the most part, other than settlements, one party wins, one party loses. And so I enjoyed the challenge, enjoyed the, you know, the strategy and really on carrying out the practices can be pretty fun. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're working for the billable hour or living and dying by the billable hour. And I was introduced I got into real estate in 2013, bought my first property. I got out of the Coast Guard. I started a gym, was doing some personal training, had some fitness classes, and I hated paying rent. And so I bought a building to vertically integrate that business that also had a commercial building. And then it also had a duplex on the property. So I worked in the commercial building, lived in the duplex, lived in the top floor, rented out the bottom floor. And, you know, the light bulb really went off when we inadvertently carried out a Burr method. We bought the property pretty cheap, put, you know, $100,000 of CapEx into it and ended up building a new building on there. And we were all into the whole property for right around $300,000. And was going to do a cash out refi and appraise for $465,000. And so we were able to basically take out all the cash we put in plus another $20,000. And that's when, and our debt service stayed pretty much the same, you know, as far as, you know, monthly cash flow goes. And so that's really when the light bulb went off for me, was in 2013.
Right, right. And what, you said the cash flow is pretty much the same. How did you float? How did you pay for it? Did you have the money on hand to pay for the repairs just from savings? How did you finance that first deal?
Yeah, so the first deal is actually pretty complicated. It was a commercial old cheese factory that we bought that had that building, and then it also had a duplex on it. And so the first year in business, I was renting a space. We saved up every dime. We ended up saving, you know, a ton of cash. And we ended up buying the property, ended up buying the note on the property. It was in default. The bank was carrying it through foreclosure. We snagged it during the foreclosure process, bought the note, and then exchanged a deed in lieu of foreclosure for a title with the previous owner. And so we did that with cash and then bank leveraged another $250,000 to first renovate the duplex and build a new commercial building for our business. That whole process took about 8 months. It was a pretty simple building. So it took about 8 months. We moved, and when we finished construction, we moved our business, you know, into the new commercial space. I was living above that. So we had cash and bank leverage. We're all in for around $300,000.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, that's great. That's great. How has your business changed? Obviously, you know, from that first transaction when it comes to financing and funding your deals, how has it changed to what you're doing today?
Oh, it couldn't be any different. It took basically a 180 degree from me doing everything and finding the deal, sourcing the capital, putting our own money in, property management, to now we're essentially a partner. We raise cash. We do 506B syndications where, you know, we're identifying the assets. And then after that, I'm relying more heavily on partnerships, you know, and vendors to really carry out the things that I'm not that great at. You know, property management, I can do it. It's not my specialty. Construction management, you know, I grew up framing houses. I am pretty familiar around power tools. I can fix anything around my house I need to, but carrying out, you know, a value add on 200 units is really out of my wheelhouse when it comes to investor cash. So I'm really sticking to what I'm good at, which is the legal piece of it. You know, I'm drafting all the PNSs, I'm drafting all the PPMs, doing all the legal work, also helping get creative with the financing. I would say that's where my specialties lie, and that's what I'm focusing on now.
Right. So you said obviously you're handling a lot of legal side of things, but then also you're going out and identifying assets and making offers and things like that. So is your sweet spot now kind of acquisitions, or what does that look like exactly?
Yeah, I would say that it's transitioning. We're doing some heavy value adds right now.
Okay.
And so we've got 64 units that were just, well, so from 2019, our business really took off in 2019. I went from, you know, owning 11 units to 575 in the last 2 years.
Congrats.
And so with that was some pretty, thank you, with some pretty, so through that we did 18 units that were 10K a door renovation, and then a 64 unit, which is 10K a door renovation, 43 unit, 10K a door renovation, 208 unit, which is around 85 to 1280, on average around 9K per door renovation. So pretty heavy value add deals. And so I would say that we spent a lot of time in 2019, early 2020 on acquisitions. And now we are really focusing on taking care of our current investors, ensuring that we have adequate time to allocate all the deals we have going right now. With that being said, we're looking at more stabilized, lower vacancy assets. Whereas 2019, we took a deal on Tulsa, just 208 unit. It was 50% vacant when we put it under contract. And to the seller's credit, it was about, you know, 40 to 35% vacant by the time we closed. But we're shying away from those deals for now until we get those squared away. So that's, you got to pivot. There's only 24 hours in a day, right? And so you can't just keep, at least in my mind, my biggest priority is my current investors and making sure their money's taken care of. And so we've got to focus on those deals we did in 2019 and 2020 and not get distracted, you know, by trying to hit a certain number. You know, I hear all these people out that want to hit 1,000 units, want to hit 5,000 units. It's like, okay, that's great, but you still got to take care of your folks that were with you in the beginning. And so for me, I'm fine going a little bit slower and just hitting our numbers, staying on track, making sure that we are being efficient and allocating our resources effectively. Because I see it all the time where folks jump in, they do too many deals too fast, and they get overwhelmed. And something in life happens, right? They get divorced. Somebody gets sick. You know, COVID happens, right? And so we're just trying to be thoughtful. And I would say, to answer your question, 2021 is really being reflective on what we did in 2019, 2020, and saying no a lot unless we're going to have adequate time to allocate.
Right, right. No, I think that's really smart. When it comes to those heavy lift projects, I mean, 50% occupied, like a lot of people do, are really, you know, scared of those. How did you guys go into those with eyes wide open? And I guess let's ask a couple of questions. How did you go into it? You know, what was your mindset there? And how did you sell it to investors?
Well, I have to give all the credit to my partners, which is Live Oak Capital. It's Jennings and Yaden Smith. They handle all the project management, and they've got, you know, over 20 years of combined experience of construction. And they, I mean, my partner Jennings was doing, he owned his own construction company for 15 years prior to me partnering with him. He's built everything, you know, custom to custom homes. And then he sold his company to Allaire, which is a Canadian-based project manager firm. And then he was a regional manager overseeing, you know, tens of millions of projects every year, and was very hands-on on building those custom homes. And those projects are way more complicated than the value add that we're carrying out. I mean, we're going in LVP flooring, granite countertops, stainless steel appliances, new paint, new roofs. And that's, you know, we're basically trying to bring it up to a Class B asset. And so from his perspective, these are pretty simple projects compared to what he was handling before. So I have to give a lot of that credit to my partners.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's interesting. How about, with those low occupancy units. You know, with those also comes, you know, some stigmas of crime and other things that kind of, they're just harder to turn around. They're in general, from what we hear. I don't own any in that kind of, you know, class, but I just hear they're a lot more difficult to own and manage. Is there any truth to that? Or have you guys really just figured out a way to tackle these head on and have been a big deal?
Yeah, one of the criteria, I mean, the area is a huge criteria for us. And Tulsa deal is a really good example. We met with a few property managers that were very optimistic about the area. Granted, the asset was a Class C asset. It was in distress, obviously, 50% occupancy. But we accredited that to really poor management and really under, it was the seller was very undercapitalized. And so it was a combination of those two factors, along with it being in a great area, that we were able to move forward. Now, I've seen higher occupancy in places like, you know, in Memphis. There was a project down there where the numbers looked okay. We thought we could go in and add value, but the area just scared us to death. And we ended up shying away from that deal because I think that was a prime example of, you know, you got new fridges and stoves going in day one, going in the front door on day one, going out the back door on day two. And so you've really got to research your market. And Tulsa has some bad areas, has some challenging areas, but we were very confident after going out there multiple times doing our research that we were in a good enough area that if we put the right property management in place, which we did, then we could bring this asset and we could bring a solid tenant base in. And that's what's showing now. As we've had the project, we've had that asset since September 1st, 2020, and occupancies we've already got it up to 80% occupied. And we're with a very solid tenant base. So we're showing, and one of the litmus tests we go is we try to develop a relationship with the local law enforcement agencies and see if we could, you know, can we rent a police officer a couple months free to gauge their interest? Because if a cop won't live there, then we don't want the asset.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I've heard of people doing that with you know, mobile home parks and things like that, like offering either a free place for them to stay or in your case, you know, a few months of free rent and things like that. But that's a really good test. You made an interesting point here when you were given kind of some of the things that the poor management had done. And you said that they were undercapitalized. What do you mean by that? And I guess, what do you mean by that? And how did that affect the seller?
Yeah, well, essentially you've got, you know, the property managers are on scene every day, right? They're trying to lease up these properties. And they're going to give you feedback. They're going to say, look, we can't lease this up when the roof is leaking. When we show the apartment, the trim's falling off or the refrigerator doesn't work or it stinks in here. And they're just going to ask you for money. And so you got to, if you're not willing to write them a check to address all the issues, if you're not willing to write them a check to A, fix the roof, to fix the trim, to get a new fridge in there, then you're putting them in a possible situation of either A, they've got to either find a lower quality tenant that's willing to live in those conditions, or they got to drop the price. And so we try to avoid that by, you know, making sure that our management companies are adequately capitalized so they have the funds they need to make sure the place is properly maintained.
Gotcha. So the owner didn't have the reserves to actually ever pay. And it's kind of downward spiral from there. Like, if the owner doesn't have the reserves to pay, then they don't have the money to give to the management company that doesn't have the ability to lease the property. So the property goes down. So the owner has less money in the end to pay. There's no making up for that lost ground.
You're circling the drain at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. How wild. And so when you guys look at assets like that, how do you underwrite something like that? Obviously, you can underwrite it based on the numbers, but there's got to also be some creative underwriting that goes into that. That you say, okay, like this, you got to see between what the numbers say. So what are some things maybe you look for in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start by drawing a comparison. So, you know, if you're going to underwrite a stabilized asset, you're looking at what's it currently bringing in, what's the current NOI. Can you bump rents by, you know, 1-3% over the next couple of years? And you get your net operating income pretty easily. With a value add project and the way that we're underwriting, we look at what it will be. And so we look at the average rent. So let's just say we've got a property where high end is getting $950, you know, middle of the road is $850, and lower quality places are $750. We're going to go in and we're going to, first thing is underwrite it pretty conservatively with the rent. So if we really think we can get $950 with a new new floors, new paint, granite countertops, new appliances, beautiful exterior, newly landscaped, new paid parking lot. If we think we can get 950, we're probably underwriting at like 875. And then we'll use a 50% expense ratio. We'll use the market vacancy for similar assets. And then we will have a pretty accurate representation of what the net operating income is going to be. Once we have an idea what the net operating income is going to be when it's stabilized, then we'll take the lower, we'll take the area cap rate. And you just take a market, you know, if you can, we got relationships with a lot of brokers that we can email and say, hey, what do you think the cap rate is in Charleston, South Carolina, Goose Creek, Tulsa? And they have a pretty good idea based on the deals they've been closing and based on what appraisals they've seen. So we'll take the cap rate. Let's just say that if it's gonna, we think it's going to appraise a 6 cap, we'll underwrite it at a 6.5 cap. And that's what we think the appraised value is going to be. Then we'll take 75% of that. And from that number, we think that's going to be our debt once we get this thing stabilized. Then we'll reverse we'll back out our construction expenses. So let's just say if we've got $1 million of CapEx expenses, let's just say it's a 100-unit building that you're going to put $10,000 per door renovation into. Well, that's $1 million renovation, right? And so we will back out that $1 million, and we need to be all in for that number. And what that allows us to do is project, this is what we think it's going to appraise for. This is what we think our next loan is going to be. This is how much our CapEx is going to be. So we need to hit this number to get all of our investors their money back within 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we underwrite. That's essentially how we underwrite it.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that. Thanks for taking the time to explain that. Have you had any challenges hitting those projections, or I guess maybe what are some things you've learned in the attempt of hitting those numbers? What are some things you've learned along the way?
You know, the biggest thing that we've really learned along the way was with our lenders, we've got to be really on top of them with when they are obligated to give us our construction draws. You know, we had a project going in South Carolina, and it seemed like the lender was under a little bit of duress. And we saw that because we really never had a problem in the beginning stages before COVID. We never had a problem getting construction draw. You know, you front the money to do the work, you carry out the work, and then they send some sort of inspector to come look at it to make sure that what you said you did, you actually did. And then they give you the money. Well, we're able to do that usually in 7 days. When COVID happened, it was taking us 30 and 60 days to get us our construction draws back. And so when we'd fronted that money, it starts to stress your cash flow a little bit if they're not getting you your draws, you know, efficiently, despite the fact that you're carrying out the work. And so we've had to have some tough conversations with our lender on either A, you either need to give us a couple of months of deferred payments. B, you need to give us an extension on this bridge loan because you're holding up. You're the reason this project is held up. If you're not going to give us the construction draws, you can't expect to hold us accountable for the timeline that you've set. And so just having those conversations and pushing back to the lender a little bit on making sure they're holding their end of the bargain with the construction draws. That's one of the biggest lessons that we've taken away.
Oh, wow. That's wild. That's wild. And how did that conversation go?
Well, it's just reason, right? You can't fight. I mean, if I'm saying that to you as a lender, you have there's nothing to say. It's like, yeah, you're right. That otherwise, either A, you're delusional, you know, or you can't use common sense. And most of the folks we're working with, they are in the multifamily lending game. They've got tons of deals going, and they've been pretty reasonable. It's just having that conversation and, you know, stressing how this is a part, stressing that, look, this is a partnership. If you guys want to get paid, we need to make sure that you're holding your end of the obligations up. Pretty basic cross-examination techniques, right? You let them fix your problems.
Right, right. That's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, I haven't heard a lot of people having issues. Maybe you have, but having issues with construction draws and things like that in 2020, but I'm certain that they are out there. And as I think, as potentially, maybe they won't, but as potentially, you know, credit, and I'm seeing it across a couple other industries as well. You know, scrutinizing loans is becoming a little bit tougher. So that's something interesting to keep in mind. What are some things you feel like you really did right as you built out your team and as you kind of figured out what your segment and what your role is going to be? What are some things you've done right in the last couple of years that have really helped you scale fast?
Oh man, picking partners and picking markets. We've been pretty lucky. We were very confident in Charleston market. I was stationed in the Coast Guard there for, you know, briefly during my stint. And so I sort of fell in love with that market then. But seeing the growth down there between, you know, Google having a shop down there, Mercedes having a great shoes, and just the overall growth of the Charleston market has really put us in a solid position with those investments. And, you know, that was stuff that was really out of our control that we did ended up making a good decision. And then picking our partners. I mean, I have the absolute best partners in the world. And we've had to have some tough conversations with folks that ended up not being partners. And we were able to dodge a couple of bullets with folks that we ended up, after going down the road with, decided we would never, ever want to be in business with.
Sure.
And so being able to have those tough conversations, even when you've got a lot of earnest money that is about to go hard and you really want to do the deal, but the partnership isn't right, and you walk away from it because you just know that this marriage is going to end in a rough divorce down the road.
Wow. Now that's tough, man. Those are difficult, difficult decisions. So you've been in that situation where you've got an asset under contract, you've got your partners potentially picked, you guys are moving downstream, and all of a sudden you go, you know what, there were some red flags, and you just packed up shop and walked away.
Right. Yep.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And it's tough. It's tough. You know, it's heartbreaking in a sense because you poured a lot of time, energy, money into the asset. And so, and you've talked to your investors about it. But, you know, if you can't walk away from the deal because despite the red flags, I think you're setting yourself up for trouble down the road.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. And that's really hard to do. I think that's really hard to do because especially in this environment when finding high quality deals is getting harder, especially if you've got a high quality deal on the line. You know, I forget who said it, but it's and I'm going to butcher it, but it's something to the effect of you can't lose money on the deal you didn't do. I mean, it's probably complete butchering, but yeah, I mean, that's kind of the same idea. Like you stopped it early. So good for you. Hey, let's jump here into the final four if we can, Nick. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Start where you are. You know, if you, there's a lot of sayings out there that, you know, doing a small deal takes as much time as doing a big deal. But I would say, figure out where you are, figure out where you're comfortable, push outside your comfort zone just a little bit, right? That's what I would recommend an aspiring investor to do. Think about what you think you could tackle, push it just a little bit.
Love that. That's great. That's great. What is one thing you're currently doing to stay on top of your game?
So I try to read a lot. I try to get up early, and I've been really focusing on Vipassana meditation lately. So 20 minutes first thing in the morning, focusing on whatever observations or just making observations of what's going on.
That's interesting. When it comes to giving back, what's one thing you're doing to make the world a better place?
Taking care of our investors. I mean, that is really what's driving me is, you know, showing folks that got hammered in 2008 that there are alternative options out here that do provide a solid return, that do provide a solid asset back opportunity. And that I'm a person they can trust with their capital that's going to put them before me.
Right. Oh, that's great. That's great. Nick, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
I'm on Facebook, Nick Brown. I'm on Instagram, Bosley's Dad, and my website, averyinvestments.me. Happy to jump on a call anytime.
Awesome. Nick, thanks so much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
Sam, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.